Welcome back to The Yak, a podcast from World Vision Australia. I'm Angus Smith. Today we are going to Mosul, a city in northern Iraq near the Syrian border. Mosul has earned a reputation as one of the most dangerous cities in the world. Violence and bloodshed followed the city's capture by the so-called Islamic State forces in 2014. The three-year occupation reduced much of the city to rubble. 2 years after the city was officially declared retaken by government forces, the question remains, is it actually safe for people to return? I'm here with Brianna Piazza, former SBS journalist turned World Vision roving reporter who has produced today's story. Bri, tell us about the current situation in Mosul.
Thanks, Angus. So July marks 2 years since it was officially declared that Iraqi armed forces had successfully pushed out the Islamic State in the city of Mosul. And that was following a bloody nine-month-long battle, which was just horrific for the thousands of people who lived through it. But fast forward to today, there are still thousands of people displaced and distressed, if not dead, as a result of the conflict in Mosul and the surrounding areas. And we're talking about a country where decades of war upon war have left close to 7 million people at the mercy of humanitarian aid. Not even children have been spared from the violence in recent conflicts, such as the 2003 Iraq War and the subsequent takeover and fall of ISIL.
There has been so much debate about the numbers of civilians seriously injured, displaced, and killed in these wars. And the exact figure is obviously impossible to know. But what sort of numbers are we talking about here? Will we ever know the full extent of the human death toll?
So not even looking at the number of living wounded and people whose livelihoods have been completely destroyed, it's actually almost impossible to calculate the exact death toll. Some household surveys estimate the death toll could be as high as 1 million since 2003. Another estimate comes from the Iraq Body Count Project, which is basically a group of people who maintain this public database of violent civilian deaths since 2003. And to do so, they draw on official figures, they cross-reference news reports, and look at hospital records even. So Iraq Body Count reports show between 183 and 205,000 civilians have died from violence in Iraq since 2003. And to put that into perspective, that's the entire population of the city of Hobart in Tasmania, Australia. Or it's enough to fill Times Square in New York City twice. It's also 68 times the number of people who died on September 11. So it's really difficult when trying to determine the number of deaths that occurred, both directly and indirectly, as a result of violence. So, for example, it's difficult to determine the number of people who may have died because of medical complications when they were fleeing the violence, and perhaps they couldn't get to a hospital in time. And authorities are still finding mass graves, but the honest truth is that we will never know exactly how many people have died due to conflicts over recent years. So I worked with Vanessa Forrest from World Vision Australia on this story. She met families in Iraq who are trying everything they can to rebuild their lives and start fresh.
Thanks, Bree. Let's hear that now.
Inside a home damaged during the bombings of Mosul, we meet a young girl named Raja. At just 10 years old, she is a casualty of war.
It was a Friday. My father went to pray and I was sitting inside my home. ISIL was shooting at the aeroplanes and the planes were dropping bombs. We were afraid that the house would collapse on us, so we started running. After passing three or four houses, a bomb landed near us.
In a split second, Raja's life changed forever.
I remember being on the ground. I looked at my hand and it was bleeding. I also looked at my stomach. It was also bleeding. I couldn't move. I was lying near my neighbor's house. They saw me and brought me inside. I was lying there until my mother came and took me to the hospital.
Raja lost her left hand in the explosion and her legs were badly damaged. She is one of the thousands of people who were injured during the nine-month battle to retake Mosul from the so-called Islamic State in 2017. The Associated Press estimates between 9 and 11,000 civilians died in the crossfire. But humanitarian organisations suspect the death toll is much higher. It's difficult to accurately count the dead, as many bodies remain buried under the rubble of Mosul's old city. Survivors will wear the injuries for the rest of their lives.
I have had two surgeries on my legs. First to bring the bones together, and then another operation. Now I finished the surgery, but I still need to go to the doctor for some physical therapy. After what happened to me, I want to be a doctor, like my doctor, the way he supported me. I want to be just like him and provide support to others. The only thing I want is for all girls' dreams to come true. I tell my friends, don't stop dreaming, and that they will have to fight to make their dreams come true.
Raja is probably one of the strongest girls you will ever meet. She is full of life and radiates so much happiness and positivity, despite having experienced so much hardship at such a young age. She is strong-willed and optimistic about the future. But there is something, she says, that makes me feel really uneasy.
After what happened to me, I wanted to be alone and not go outside. Sometimes I want to be near the door of our home to feel the sunshine. But otherwise, I wanted to be alone in the house.
So we know that surviving war doesn't just leave physical scars. There is the mental and emotional impact that children have to cope with as well, often without support or medical help. I see cases like this all the time. My name is Vanessa Forrest, and I develop and oversee humanitarian relief projects for World Vision across the Middle East. Through my work, I've met so many children like Raja. We set up safe spaces for children to play and learn, and we help them access support for psychosocial needs in conflict zones across the world. In Iraq alone, World Vision has helped more than 126,000 children through protection, psychosocial support, and education programs. Here's my colleague, Kaylin Briggs, who will explain why these programs are so critical. She's a senior advisor for conflict and displacement.
My background is in the protection of vulnerable people in conflict settings. And I was working in Iraq and in Mosul in mid-2017. Setting up a protection program there for another humanitarian organization. I have never seen destruction like I have on the western half of Mosul. The streets were pretty much completely empty when I was there. And basically the streets were just filled with rubble because the shelling and the aerial bombardment was so heavy that it did look a little bit like an apocalypse. Children who fled Mosul and who fled sort of neighboring villages and areas as well, they would have experienced a range of quite traumatic experiences and events. So they may have personally been affected by violence or seen it or experienced it themselves. But even just sort of hearing of it and being immersed in a situation where you do have to flee your homes and potentially become separated from your family or your extended social network, all of those experiences have a really lasting effect on children. And so one of the main concerns with sort of these types of events is making sure that we provide psychosocial support to children and families who have been affected by the conflict and who have been affected by violence. I think the impacts on people vary from person to person, and it's difficult to say that that it will have the same impact on everyone. I think I met some people who were incredibly resilient and despite everything they went through said, as soon as it's safe, I'm going to go back home and I'm going to restart my life. And there was a real determination to not let this sort of overcome them forever. But at the same time, there were other people who had lost everything. And so I think there was a bit of despair at times of, you know, what am I going back to?
So it's not just about basic needs. When people think of aid, they think of water, food, shelter, the basic things. These needs are obviously critical, but increasingly we need to consider the other needs of children as they start to recover. We've done a lot of research into this, and what we've found is that children in conflict zones face great risks on so many levels. Violence and displacement lead to negative coping strategies of families who are struggling to survive.
So one of those negative coping strategies, for example, could be families choosing to marry off their daughters early as a way of alleviating some of the strain on the family to provide food for many children or just to meet their basic economic needs. And so while it's completely understandable as a coping strategy, it has very damaging effects on the young girls who are affected by it. But we also know that displacement camps are very dangerous places to be a child and to be a girl or to be a woman, and that there's risks everywhere in the world in displacement settings. So there are risks just of people not having sort of the basic security and safety and privacy and, you know, needing to walk to a latrine in the middle of the night without lighting. There's a risk of sexual violence and harassment. So there are, you know, risks that people experienced as they fled the conflict itself, but then also risks that people experience as they continue their lives in displacement. So it's not just people who left and went to camps that were affected by it. It's also people who remained in the cities, sometimes trapped in the cities, who also experienced really significant violence, but then also have ongoing protection needs.
In Iraq, there's the added complexity of documentation not being officially recognised if it was issued to people who were living in areas under ISIL occupation. That includes birth certificates for babies who were born in areas under ISIL control. There's currently an estimated 45,000 displaced children in camps who are missing documentation. Without it, they face exclusion from Iraqi society, and they are deprived of their most basic human rights. For example, without documentation, they are unable to attend school or access healthcare. When kids have experienced war firsthand, the most important thing is to restore their sense of normality. So, for example, a stable learning environment, opportunities to study, to take exams, to finish school, socialise, and access important psychosocial support. We find ways to help kids realise their full potential and achieve their goals. That may include finding a creative art, a sport to enjoy, or even playing music. One of the many talents Raja has discovered is writing and singing music.
I like singing the song, I fly. You have to sing with all your heart. Now, I like to go outside and see other people, to be happy and to enjoy myself. The feeling I have when I am drawing, I want to be in this place. When I am drawing mountains, I want to be in mountains. When I am drawing trees, I want to be under the trees. I am drawing my feelings.
While children use music to escape the horrors they've witnessed, much of Western Mosul remains in ruins. And the house, which Raja spent her life happily growing up in, still has damaged walls and a leaky ceiling in need of repair. Her family doesn't have enough money to fix it.
United Nations agencies estimate up to 90% of this historic city has been damaged and destroyed, and satellite images and field surveys indicate 8 million tonnes of debris are scattered across the city.
International media crews documented the scale of destruction from aerial bombardment and ground fighting as the fight for Mosul unfolded.
Is where the battle is really intensifying.
A lot of coalition planning, American air power.
I am confident that just as ISIL's been defeated in communities across Iraq, ISIL will be defeated in Mosul as well.
Tens of thousands more still trapped behind enemy lines, with reports that children are being used as human shields.
This is the worst devastation I've seen in all my years with UNHCR. These people have lost everything.
Mosul emerged as one of Iraq's hardest hit areas. Vital infrastructure gone, homes and businesses destroyed, bodies buried in the rubble. Iraqi authorities estimate it will cost up to $7 billion and decades to rebuild the old city of Mosul. This was a place full of historic, religious and cultural sites, including the iconic 800-year-old Al-Nuri Mosque.
Time almost stands still when the morning prayer echoes through the streets of northern Iraq. It's the only sound you hear before dawn. Everything else is quiet until the peak hour traffic starts. This is a country that bears so many scars of the past. Most Australians know about the recent conflicts, like the Iraq War of 2003, when the United States and allied forces, including Australia, decided to put boots on the ground. The Australian Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, famously alleged,
"Iraq must not be allowed to possess weapons of mass destruction. For the security and stability of our world, Iraq must be disarmed."
And years later, the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, publicly announced,
"The intelligence assessments made at the time of going to war turned out to be wrong. The aftermath turned out to be more hostile, protracted and bloody than ever we imagined."
And in the chaos of the conflict emerged further hostilities and tensions. We saw the rise of ISIL, a group that wanted to set up a society to follow strict interpretation of Islamic law. Cities like Mosul and surrounding areas in northern Iraq were heavily impacted.
These are images of utter desperation, of families running out of food and water and in constant fear for their lives. The Yazidis have fled the militant Islamic State as fighters made more gains today.
Where ISIS takes over, life changes. This organization has a history of abducting and killing doctors, academics, and journalists.
But the reality is, literally every decade since the Great Iraqi Revolution of 1920 has seen conflict of some sort in this country. There hasn't been a single generation over the past century that hasn't been touched by violence. Who knows if it will be any different for this generation? A group of us travelled to Hassan Sham camp, which sits outside Mosul. It was almost surreal. We were driving along a highway that leads from a somewhat normal city of Erbil towards the chaos of Mosul.
Yeah, it's strange to think that not very long ago that bridge was out and this was a battlefront.
Yeah.
Looking at it now, it seems very tranquil.
People who managed to escape Mosul and surrounding areas that came under attack fled to camps like Hassan Sham. Today, there are 1.7 million Iraqis who are displaced, many of them living in camps just like this one. Some of them have tried to return home, but found it wasn't safe or realised there was nothing there for them anymore. So they have returned to camps. One of the reasons? Unexploded ordnance and landmines. Iraq is listed in the world's top five most heavily mined countries due to years and years of conflict. But the recent bombardments have only made the situation even more dangerous for civilians. The United Nations estimates there are at least 10 million mines, with every province in northern Iraq affected. Civilians, and often children, are usually the ones maimed or killed by landmines. The situation is so bad that unfortunately aid agencies like World Vision are working with Mine Action Group to teach children how to avoid landmines and unexploded ordnance in Iraq. I met with the principal while I was visiting a school where UNESCO is funding a program to help children get back into education. We work with schools like this across northern Iraq. We use this as an opportunity to teach kids about the daily threats of mines so they can protect themselves.
I hear that this morning we're doing mine awareness training.
Yes.
Is it possible for her to tell me why she says that is important for the students?
It's very important because most of the children in this school are from Mosul. The places that were captured by ISIL are still not clear of explosives. Thus, it's very important that staff raise awareness about explosives. We are currently teaching staff and students and families returning home, and they need to know about the risk. Many areas haven't yet been cleared by expert teams.
I'm wondering if she has a view of how children feel about the prospect of going home, whether that's what they want, whether they think that'll be soon.
I was expecting to have half of the students that I have this year, but I'm shocked the number of students has actually nearly doubled because people and their families want to stay here for their safety so they can live in peace. Some people decide to go back to the areas that were meant to be safe. There were 10 students who returned home, but then they came back here again. Even the areas where they live and the homes are surrounded by armed forces who control the area. Most of their properties have been demolished.
So even though people are being encouraged to return home, once they do, many choose to leave again. They leave because there's nothing there for them. No work, no livelihoods, sometimes not even basic services like schools and hospitals. There's the danger of violence and unexploded ordnance that still scatter farms, roads and schools. So people end up in camps, some in Iraq and some across the border. It's not necessarily because life is better in camps, it's just that people feel safer there and can create their own life for themselves. The United Nations Mine Action Service estimates it will take at least 8 years to make Mosul safe from unexploded bombs. And that's not even including rural areas and other cities. But so many people we talk to say they can't just put their lives on hold for decades. They need to earn income, no matter what. For farmers, this means returning to their land to grow food, even though they know there might be unexploded ordnance sitting underneath the soil. This is me speaking to a group of local residents from Tel Afa.
So when we went to the farmers, to their villages, they told us that some farms have mines,
mm-hmm.
So then they can't cultivate it.
Yep. They don't have access to their land.
Yes.
So
yep.
they need to clear their area so they can farm it again.
Yep.
Many farmers suffer from that after war, and there's children who died because of this.
There are some groups doing an incredible job of trying to address this mammoth, almost impossible task, cleaning up the millions of unexploded devices planted over the several decades of different wars in Iraq. It's an extremely dangerous job.
My name is Gabrielle Brophy and I'm Senior Program Officer for Mines Advisory Group International, known as MAG, based in Iraq.
Prior to joining MAG, I hadn't really considered mine action as critical to humanitarian relief work. I had worked on a number of other humanitarian responses, but predominantly worked in country after natural disasters. Soon after joining, I quickly realised that mine action is absolutely critical to humanitarian efforts in conflict-affected areas.
More often than not, it's civilians that are killed or injured.
conventional landmines were planted and left from conflicts prior to ISIS. On the other hand, ISIS designed devices for substantial impact, making them sensitive enough to be triggered by a child, but powerful enough to disable a tank. ISIS manufactured devices on an industrial scale and made the different components in factories, which have been found in places like Mosul. Most are still victim-operated, so the armed group who planted them can be long gone, but the devices are still active and extremely dangerous. The devices are unprecedented, not just because of the sheer volume that we are finding them, but also due to the substantial amount of explosives used for each device, and often multiple ways for them to be triggered.
In Mosul, families have returned to homes that have been booby-trapped intentionally, and the tactics are shocking. Imagine if opening the bathroom door or lifting a toilet seat set off a bomb, or picking up a copy of the Quran triggered an explosion. These are real cases that have been recorded. Children have even been injured whilst setting off booby traps in schools and in the playground.
One family returned to their home in Tulaband, a village to the east of Mosul, after Kurdish forces had retaken the area from ISIS. Sadly, one of the family members set off an improvised landmine at the front door and instantly killed three of the family members.
MAG has 110 trained teams on the ground, working in some of the most heavily mined areas of northern Iraq. They estimate defensive landmines cover hundreds of kilometres. Iraqis in rural areas eagerly await the rains to come every year. Iraq has a very dry climate, and so the rains provide a key source of drinking water and to nourish crops. But it's met with mixed feelings, because the vital source of life is also killing people. Floods carry landmines and other devices to new places. It makes this territory even more dangerous, because areas that had already been deemed safe could suddenly have landmines appear overnight. It's the threat that never ends.
Rain heavier than spitting makes it too dangerous for the D-miners to work in active minefields, reducing the time that clearance work can be done. The mountainous areas of the Kurdistan region have challenging terrain for their teams to work, meaning that the machines are unable to be used and D-miners have to work slower on steep slopes. It also snows in the mountains over the winter months, making it impossible for clearance work to continue until it dries out.
And if that wasn't bad enough, teams say extreme weather events are making their jobs even more difficult.
We just came out of a longer than usual winter where we had substantial rainfall causing a lot of flooding, particularly in the northern parts of Iraq. In the Kurdistan region of Iraq, where there is still a great deal of minefields and unexploded ordnance from previous conflicts, the flooding caused landslides in some areas, which in some cases moved landmines away from minefields well known to the local community, or uncovered landmines that were buried deeper in the ground. In the flatter areas of the Nineveh Plains, heavy rains flooded improvised minefields, washed away bridges and flooded roads, which meant that teams were unable to work on or get access to sites until the flooding receded.
In this context, and with many people worried about the threat of further violence, many people are too scared to return home.
The fear of landmines and explosives is still felt by men, women and children even decades after they've been planted, and impacts the stabilisation and development of communities. So it is critical that we keep pushing the international community to commit and hold to conventions like the Mine Ban Treaty, and that a no landmine norm is established and continued.
A total of 6 million Iraqis were displaced between 2011 and 2017. And a third of them have still not returned home. Some families have gone home and settled in abandoned buildings, train stations, or even construction sites. Dahlia is from a Yazidi village, and her family's story is very typical. She has 9 children, and both her and her husband can't find work.
Navim Dahlia. My name is Dalia. I have 9 children. Both my husband and I are jobless, and we cannot afford to send our children to school. Last year, a young girl and a boy knocked on our door. They said they were from the humanitarian organization, the livelihood sector, and that they wanted to help us. The veterinary has supported us and provided instructions on what to do if they have any problems. When we went to the sheep shed and opened the door, we saw that a sheep had just given birth to a small lamb. I kissed it. And during the following 10 days, the other 3 gave birth. So now we have 4 lambs added to our cattle. For the first days, I stored my sheep milk, but then I shared it with my neighbors as a charity, because we have gotten benefit from the charity others have shown towards us. I want my cattle to be increased in number, so that I will be able to open a shop in the next year and be able to sell cheese, yogurt, and cheap wool to develop income for my children.
People are trying to rebuild their lives in this context where there's a lot of fear and distrust, particularly towards many of the displaced Iraqis who are thought to have lived under or perhaps even worked for or supported ISIL. ISIL has lost territory, but authorities report there are tens of thousands of IS fighters scattered across the globe. Many people are still scared that the threat has not gone away. But for now, I'll leave you with the children of Mosul. They still dream of home. They have hope, even though home isn't what it used to be.
Our village was big.
We had a garden. Our house was huge.
It was nice to play in the garden.
We saw IS.
They were arresting us and humiliating us in front of other people. They were firing weapons at every house.
The airstrike was so strong and the sound went like...
I've seen bombs, airplanes, and heard the sound of rockets.
They were shooting bullets towards people. They were scaring everyone.
We were terrified, and we were thinking that now the airstrike would hit us and we would die.
It wasn't good there.
When I was there, I had nightmares, but here I don't have any.
Here is much better.
Chair I can play, more so I couldn't play.
We should love each other, respect each other, and help each other.
I wish that there would be peace and we could feel more safe and secure.
I'd like to have a big house and a fancy car. I'd like to have a car that looks like a white swan.
I wish we could be happy.
Yak is a podcast by World Vision Australia. Thanks to Vanessa Forrest and Brianna Piazza for producing today's episode, and Zane McIntosh, our incredible audio engineer. If you'd like to find out more about the humanitarian crisis in Iraq, you can visit the World Vision website, where you can find out more about the work we're doing, which includes providing psychosocial support and life-saving assistance. Talk to us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at the Yak Podcast. Our webpage is worldvision.com.au/theyak. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're going to take a mid-season break and be back in 4 weeks on Monday, the 29th of July. I'm Angus Smith. Thanks for listening.